Today on This Week in Law, Bood Radley, Karl Marx, and copyright, digital potty training, John Oliver gets weird and incisive with outgoing NSA chief Keith Alexander, how not to be targeted, and much more with Bruce Schneier, Mark Paulding, and Kyle Courtney, next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 257, recorded May 2nd, 2014. Clamshell phones and gas-powered copiers. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by NatureBox, where you can order great-tasting, healthy snacks delivered right to your door. Forget the vending machine and get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like blueberry almond bites. To get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. Hi there, I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We've got an amazing panel for you today. We're going to focus a lot on privacy and security issues, but don't worry, we'll throw in some copyright and entertainment stuff for you too. We've got Bruce Schneier joining us today, a widely respected author and cryptographer, one of the world's foremost experts on issues of privacy and security. Bruce, we're so thrilled to have you on the show.
Yeah, it's fun to be here.
Also joining us from Harvard University, where he is counsel in charge of the entire Harvard library system, is Kyle Courtney. Hello, Kyle.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful to have you here. And I'm sorry that our traditional co-host, Evan Brown, isn't with us this week, but Evan has kindly sent us one of his colleagues, Mark Paulding, who also is an expert on privacy and information security. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Denise. I'm happy to be here.
Wonderful to have you. So since we have lots and lots of privacy stuff to discuss, let's go there first. All right. Well, for anyone who doesn't already read Bruce Schneier, Colbert-esque wag of the finger at you, you should be, because Bruce definitely pays attention to you and helps all the rest of us understand the important issues related to privacy and security. And in his book a while back, coined the term security theater, relating to what goes on at airports. So I thought we would start there, Bruce, since that might be where people have heard of you before, if they haven't already, is from that term, because we've had a bit of a development in what the TSA does and how they treat people going through airport security. The TSA PreCheck program first went into effect back in 2011, but is starting to get more and more uptake, especially as Global Entry members and other border search systems that the TSA has in place are able to use TSA PreCheck. And also, it's kind of near and dear to my heart since my son and I are now members, and we've used it a couple of times, and it's like going back to traveling in the early 80s, where, you know, you just would waltz through security. You kept all your clothes on, you kept all your shoes on, things stayed in your bag, including all of your toiletries, all of your electronic devices, and you didn't have to worry about going through backscatter x-ray scanners. So it's sort of back to the future here as far as PreCheck goes, and now they are extending the program to international airlines as well. And I wondered, from the standpoint of security theater, what you think, Bruce, about this going back in time, once, of course, the people involved in the program have given up a good deal of information about themselves.
Well, I don't know about the of course, but that's what's happening. It's funny you talk about the 80s, that this is like the 80s. The 80s actually was a much worse time for terrorism. We don't think that. We don't believe it, because we believe terrorism is singularly the threat of this new century. There's a lot more terrorism on airplanes in the 80s than there is today. I'm a big fan of PreCheck. I've had it for years. I fly a lot. And going back to sensible security, I think it makes things a lot easier. My problem with PreCheck, unfortunately, is that it's really reserved for those who pay, for those who fly a lot, for those who are in other programs. So it really makes a class division. And my fear is that once the rich people are going through normal security, that the horrible post 9/11 security will stay because nobody will realize how bad it is anymore. I think PreCheck level security is what airport security should look like. I don't think it needs a background check. I think it should be available to everybody. So the more people, the better. But I do worry about the class differential.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The global entry program that my son and I joined was $150 per traveler. I can't see a whole lot of people springing for that. PreCheck itself is $85 a traveler, so it's still a pretty hefty fee. The other concern I have that I wonder if you share, Bruce, is now having gone through the process, I don't feel like a terribly thoroughgoing background check was done. Now, my 10-year-old son, perhaps one might not have been necessary, but for 49-year-old me, you know, I would have expected more questions and a more thoroughgoing look at what I've been up to. And it was kind of a rubber stamp process. I mean, I don't know what goes on behind the scenes, but I can tell you that it was very quick and cursory.
Well, when I got it for free because I was a frequent flyer. So there's absolutely no interaction with me. Just magically, I had it. Again, I don't think that any background check is necessary. So if it's cursory, if it's dumb, I don't care. Just as long as people can get through airport security like they're supposed to and not have this post 9/11 craziness. So global entry is harder. I'm in that program too. That requires the fee plus an interview. You actually go to the airport at a time you're not flying, which is really weird. And then a sit-down interview. So that takes time. Right. So the people who have global entry are business travelers, people who fly a lot, because then it makes sense. We're now seeing PreCheck. I mean, I've noticed over the years that PreCheck's been in operation, more and more people, I think of them as amateurs, going through the PreCheck line, where they don't know what to do. They don't know what they're not supposed to do. And they're all very confused and very slow. I mean, PreCheck works best when we're all going fast through the line. And as it expands, I assume more people will get used to, again, pre-9/11, more normal security. I mean, it is a shame that we have to have these systems to get people there. There are airports that it looks like they're moving people through the PreCheck line kind of randomly. And I don't know if there's any profiling going on as to who goes in there. But I'll see people who are not PreCheck people in the PreCheck line. So there's a lot of stuff going on with TSA. You know, for example, liquids seem not to be much of a problem anymore. I haven't, even non-PreCheck, taken my liquids bag out of my suitcase in a long time, and no one seems to care. I have bottles that are a little bit over, and no one seems to care. You don't have a big water bottle, no one's paying any attention anymore. That was done with a whole lot, with not a lot of fanfare. So there definitely are changes. I think we are trying to get back to normal, sane airport security, even though it's a slow and hard process.
Yeah, some of the coverage I've been reading about PreCheck does mention that when the PreCheck line is short or non-existent, that they will profile, as you say, persons in the other line and bring out people who they feel would be good PreCheck candidates. It almost sounds like it's a marketing tool too to get people, oh, if you haven't tried this before, give it a try. You might enjoy not having to take your shoes off, et cetera. And the other funny thing I've noticed is, to your point of people not knowing to do once they get in the PreCheck line, is we've all become accustomed to the TSA agents standing there, you know, kind of lecturing you sometimes through a bullhorn, telling you what you have to take off and where to put things and what goes in what bin. In the PreCheck line, they're doing it too, but they're telling you just the opposite. They're telling you, keep your sweaters on, keep your shoes on, nothing has to come out of your bag. So they're having to unteach everything that they've taught before. Mark, what is your take from the privacy and security standpoint on all this?
Well, I generally agree with Bruce. I have a similar view that a lot of the security that's been put in place over the past 10, 15 years has been rather excessive. I have not done PreCheck, though. I haven't done it yet. I haven't been traveling as much in the last year or two, so I haven't reached a point where it made economic sense to invest in it yet, but I expect that to change soon. So I suppose I'll get used to being able to wear shoes with laces in the airport again. That might be nice. It's a good thing I like loafers, so it wasn't a big change for me. But I think there's been so little evidence that the heightened security measures have had practical impact on security that, you know, much like Bruce, I just think that's the way airport security should be.
Bruce, how do you feel? You've said a couple of times you think everyone should have a pre-check caliber check at the airport. Tell us why that's sufficient? And secondly, do you think the TSA will eventually get there?
Well, eventually is a long time. I think it's impossible after the rest of the history of our country will be in this insane terrorists are going to kill us all mentality. So yes, we're going to get back to normal levels of threat, normal levels of risk assessment, normal levels of security. It might take a generation, but we're certainly going to get back there. As to why it's sufficient, it's sufficient because it's not the enhanced security isn't going to catch anybody. Now, you think about terrorism, there are two basic kinds of terrorists. There are your random nutcases and then there are your professionals. The random nutcases, any airport security is going to catch, right? They're bringing a gun, they're bringing a knife, they're bringing a bomb. They're kind of obvious. Airport security catches those people. The professionals design their plot so that airport security doesn't catch it. I mean, sort of think about pre-check. If I had a team of terrorists, I'm going to have everyone apply for pre-check, and the two that get it are the ones that go on the mission. And all of these enhanced securities assume that the terrorist doesn't know about them. And you know, we all do know. If you think about the liquid bombers, they picked a plot that was designed to go through airport security at the time. The underwear bomber picked a plot designed to go through airport security. The notion that we're going to defend against what the terrorist did last week is kind of fanciful. So you look at the two types of threats. The first type, pre-9/11 security does great against. The second type, post-9/11 security doesn't do great against. So we might as well go to pre-9/11 security, take all that extra money, put it in investigation and intelligence, the things that actually work, regardless of the plot, regardless of the tactic, regardless of the target. So it's sort of a basic cost-benefit analysis. Airport security is the last line of defense, and it's not a very good one. You know, shoring it up doesn't make us much safer.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yep. Kyle, have you been traveling lately, and what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I actually just came back from Congress a month ago, well, maybe 3 weeks ago, and I saw the pre-check lane for the first time because I was flying JetBlue. Being unaware of that. And this was, it was exactly what Bruce was saying. I was in the express lane, the one where you can go through security a little faster, not wait on the big line. And they moved me into the pre-check lane. And I kind of asked, I'm like, well, I'm not pre-checked. And they were like, oh, well, it's a new service. And they advertised it to me in a way. Mm-hmm. So it's exactly what happened. And, you know, I've been wearing loafers for, you know, years now, so I would agree with that as well. But I was surprised at the price. Background checks cost money to do in the employment world. But they told me it was $85 for 5 years, I think, is what they said.
That's right.
And they didn't tell me about the international. I had no idea about that. But I guess if it's getting people moving through the airport faster and it still has the psychological component, which I think a lot of the TSA's actions were to deal with the public at large and their nerves about the post 9/11 environment, I think it'll work. But the socioeconomic aspect of it is interesting. Yeah,
it is. And we were talking about, you know, the obvious drawbacks of creating a class system when it comes to airport security. But this whole notion that they're marketing the program aggressively to people who aren't already members of it, and the fact that it is pricey, hints at the fact that the TSA views this as some kind of profit center. What do you make of that, Bruce?
You know, I don't know. I don't think we know how expensive these background checks are. I mean, they're not going to be free, but as we've talked about, they're not very extensive. So I don't know who's making money on this. It does disturb me because we're all sitting here talking about this really from a position of privilege. You know, we fly a lot. We learn the old rules. We learn the new rules. We're learning some new rules. So someone who's flying once a year, once every other year, you know, it's a big deal, and it's a big amount of money. And, you know, they're going to airports not knowing what the rules are. I mean, they haven't flown in a couple of years. They hear a lot of stories. They hear me talking. They hear you talking. And everyone's saying different things, from you're going to get a really invasive pat down to you can keep your shoes on. So there's not a lot of people know it. And you can tell if you actually go fly during times when a lot of people don't fly regularly fly. You know, Christmas break, spring break for schools. It's much slower because people just don't know the rules because it's not something they're facile with.
Yeah, it's not something that takes up a whole lot of time in most people's daily life, I'm sure. Well, we put these phrases into the show, a couple of them per show, so that people who are listening for continuing legal or other professional education credit can demonstrate that they've watched or listened to the show. And so let's make the first one, keep your shoes on. And if you need more information about CLE credit for listening to or watching This Week in Law, head on over to our wiki at wiki.twit.tv, and our show page there has much more information for you.
So this is a security measure for making sure people are paying attention?
Yeah, no, it's just a random way to demonstrate. There are some oversight bodies that say, okay, well, you listened to that show or watched it. We need some further proof that you actually did. And, you know, this show's almost 2 hours long. So we drop these phrases in so that they're secret phrases. It's kind of like Groucho Marx's secret void. Got a couple of them. Let's move on to recently when I was not flying, I was driving around the Bay Area in Northern California and spotted a billboard by iDrive. And I guess they put a bunch of these billboards all around San Francisco to coincide with Macworld. And their push, and they did a press release on this too, was that iDrive was providing NSA-proof cloud backup. And focusing on the fact that they're offering end-to-end encryption for their cloud backup. So I want to probe this with you, Bruce, and see what you think about marketing your products to thwart surveillance and how effective you think, you know, is this false advertising by any chance?
Well, I mean, it's a couple of questions. You know, the first one is actually saying that if they get a U.S. government court order, they will ignore it. I mean, one of the ways the NSA gets at your data is they go to the FISA court and get a warrant for your data. So what does that mean? The other way the NSA gets at your data is they go into the system and find a flaw, break in, and take your data. And I don't think that they can guarantee that their software doesn't have any flaws. If it is, it's the first time in the history of mankind that we've come up with software with flaws. That'd be kind of neat, but I'm not going to bet that way. So looking at the two basic ways the NSA has to get in, one is through the front door and the other is through the back door, I'm not sure how they can viably claim to protect you against either. I think all they can claim is they're using good cryptography. And we hope they're using it properly. Who knows? One of the ways to check, of course, is to lose your key and ask for a backup. If they can give you a backup, then all bets are off here.
Right.
But I'm not impressed. Unfortunately, you know, the best you can do, Howard Schmidt, I'm blanking on his name, the CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, said at South by Southwest something like, we're pretty sure the NSA can't get into our data streams. That's probably the best you can do. We're pretty sure, right? Except for the ways we are legally obligated not to tell you about, except for the ways that we don't know about. That's probably a better marketing claim. NSA proof, I'm less, I don't know, I don't trust it.
Well, it's certainly a more trustworthy marketing claim, maybe not as an effective one.
Well, it's probably more effective, just going to be less accurate. I mean, you know, good marketing claims are effective. I like ones that are actually truthful.
That would be a good thing. The law likes that too. Mark, I don't know if you read through the articles we had in the rundown about this, but there are quite a few products who are using public concern about government surveillance to market themselves these days. And I'm wondering if you're watching closely to see if they go too far.
Well, I have been watching it, and I will say that earlier in my legal career, I did a lot of consumer protection, deceptive advertising work. So I have to say, as soon as I hear or read those claims, a little bit of an alarm goes off in my head. But that said, you know, I think to take a point that Bruce brought up earlier, what a lot of these services are claiming to do is they're claiming to avoid the court issue by essentially engineering their systems so that only the user would have possession of the keys to the data. So even though the service may store the information in the cloud, the representation is that the data is encrypted on the client side before it's actually transferred to their servers, their cloud servers. So then in theory, if they never take possession of the key, they never know the key, they can never actually be forced to give the key to the government. Of course, I share Bruce's concern in that, you know, that is very dependent on how they actually engineer the system. And obviously, I'm not privy to that information, but I would be very hesitant to go all the way out on the limb of saying NSA proof, if for no other reason than it's sort of like drawing a giant bullseye on your service. You know, particularly if assume you're actually successful, then in theory, people who actually have a reason to be concerned about the NSA and who the NSA might actually be interested in surveilling may decide to try to use your service, which is, you know, pretty much a like I said, putting a bullseye on your service and saying, well, yeah, we double dog dare you, NSA. And I'm a little skeptical that most private companies are going to invest the kind of money and resources necessary to harden a system to be NSA proof.
Yeah, remember, it's not just the NSA, of course. I mean, that's what they're using, but it's going to be, you know, the Chinese government as well. So the people who are going to use that system are going to need it to stay alive. And that's the way you have to think about it. And sure, there are lots of systems that we use that we recommend that dissidents in very dangerous countries use, and they are NSA proof and other organization proof. You know, we do know, unfortunately, that the NSA is not beyond forcing companies to change their business models and lie about it. So we know that, for example, Skype. Microsoft bought Skype, and the U.S. government, the NSA, possibly through the FBI, mandated that Microsoft make some changes in how Skype works. We don't know the details, to make it more eavesdropping friendly. And then, of course, not tell their users and customers. So, you know, the problem is that as long as the company is inside the U.S., it is subject to some very draconian U.S. laws about surveillance. And we don't know if we can trust those claims. Now, which countries are better? I mean, there are some out there. There are a lot of countries that are worse. I mean, if a Chinese product said NSA proof, we would look at it and say, yeah, but, you know, the Chinese government is going to get it all. So in a sense, you have to pick your enemies. But these claims are, you know, I don't know if they're dangerous, but the political climate is trumping technology at this point. You know, because of all of these laws requiring access, the technological claims almost can't be trusted.
Yeah, that's an excellent observation. Kyle, I know you focus more on copyright issues as far as communications and data storage at Harvard are concerned, but certainly in working with the library system, you're dealing with a lot of sensitive data that hopefully people can trust to remain private. And I wonder if you've thought about how that data is being stored and if this is on the radar screen for folks in your kind of situation.
Sure. Library records are protected usually in the same manner that other sensitive records are protected. There's actually a lot of state laws dealing with you can't just come in and seize library records of individuals that have checked out books, that have accessed the internet. In fact, there was a whole host of gag orders for libraries in New England where the FBI had come in and basically said, we want to know who used this computer, when, what books they checked out, et cetera. So typically, it's much like any other kind of getting at data. It's subject to a subpoena or a warrant. However, these marketing claims of NSA proof, I believe them to be more gimmicky than actually, you know, it's like saying there's certain amount of pomegranate juice in pomegranate. I saw something about this the other night. It's an FTC kind of consumer protection decision. But then again, if you are the owner of this data and you're the only person with the keys, the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution protects a person against being incriminated by his own compelled testimonial communications. So in my mind, I think that there is this double down here. The companies are putting the burden on you to take the Fifth, in a sense, on your data. That being said, the NSA is building a supercomputer, supposedly, that could hack any of these things, library records, terabytes of data held on these iDrives or these NSA-proof drives. So I'm not sure anything is 100% safe, but I seem to think that these billboards are a little more gimmicky, commercial-oriented than they are actually saying we are NSA-proof.
Bruce, do you have any insights on that latter point, on the NSA being able to break any kind of end-to-end encryption?
They can't. It's a myth. Mm-hmm. We know that from a lot of Snowden documents, that cryptography still gives them a lot of trouble, at least at scale. Most of how they break crypto systems is by getting around them, by stealing keys, by leveraging default keys and bad implementations and software bugs. That breaking the math is not something they can do regularly. Now, they do have advances in math. That giant supercomputer is going to be for storage and analysis, less right. Cryptanalysis. And mm-hmm. So, no, crypto is still a great solution. I do have a question for the lawyers on this panel. Do we have definitive case law that revealing an encryption key counts as self-incrimination? Because from what I know, the jury is still out on that question, that it hasn't been decided. And certainly in the UK, you can be compelled.
I don't think it's decided. I don't think it's decided. However, you had that border case in Vermont a few years ago. I think it's Boucher. And in this case, it was an ICE agent that had already seen the contents of the laptop. But unfortunately, they closed the laptop and the PGP privacy protection took hold. And when they tried to compel that defendant to give over the password, he resisted. He won at a lower court. But at the middle court, they said it's a foregone conclusion that the government knows that that's there.
We didn't really decide on the actual merits of revealing the key in Fifth Amendment.
Absolutely. Yes. They're saying there was no testimonial thing. We know it's there. The contents of the nature of the thing demanded would not compel testimony communication. That's the one that I'm aware of. I don't know if anyone else has another case that's similar.
I'm not aware of anything more definitive than that. And I would say it's difficult to project how the Supreme Court or the circuit courts would really rule on that question down the road. So I would say it's not definitive in the U.S. I suppose the thing to say in the United States is there's still an argument as opposed to in the U.K.
Yeah, and we've talked at different times on the show, you know, when one of these, I'm asserting the Fifth Amendment as to a password or encryption key cases comes along, we follow it and talk about it on the show. And the ones that we've followed and discussed have gone both ways. So yeah. I agree. There's no definitive answer, and that certainly asserting the Fifth Amendment is alive and well, but there's no guarantee that it's going to prevail. Let's move on to the bathroom, shall we? Bruce, you pointed to something on your blog that is just pretty darn hilarious. And that is a company that, you know, I love it when companies do this. They want to bring attention to what they consider. Actually, this wasn't probably a company, but more an advocacy group. Maybe you can bring me up to speed on that, Bruce. But someone came up with a fake company that they, quote unquote, launched at the ACM Conference on Human Factors in Computing, an event where researchers discuss the science of how people interact with technology. And this got written up at the Atlantic. And the name of the faux company was Quantified Toilets. And it took a lot of people in. This was, you know, there are smart toilets out there. We've on the show before discussed that having a digital diaper record information for parents about your child's toileting habits is actually not a false idea, but something that's been floated before. Oh, no pun intended there at all. but this Quantified Toilets idea was supposed to exist in the Toronto Convention Center and other civic venues and was supposed to, you know, gather data from what went on in the restroom. In fact, turned out to be a hoax and designed to draw attention to the fact that, gee, you know, this could actually happen and people aren't really responding with outrage or dismay. So, Bruce, do you want to give us some thoughts on this?
Yeah, sort of interesting. The idea is that there's a device that's measuring things about you. The quantified comes from the quantified self movement. So people who wear Fitbits and other devices on their wrists that will measure their movement and make some medical measurements and give you a lot of data about yourself. The difference here is this was something that was being done by a third party. It was in a public restroom. That was the idea. In a sense, it's similar to some of the tracking devices in stores, in department stores, that will track individual customers around and see what they're standing near, what they're looking at, what they're considering buying. And there's a lot of this data. It's the Internet of Things. It's all of these sensors. And the idea was this was built as an art project to make people aware of some of the very, very draconian surveillance possibilities that are here or just around the corner. I do think it's an issue that we have to pay attention to. You know, and whether it's a Fitbit on your wrist or whether it's something in a store, who's collecting that data? What's being done with it? How is it being stored? How is it being bought and sold? You know, in a lot of cases, we don't know. In a company, 23andMe, another sort of a similar idea where you give them your genetic data and they give you back, you know, stuff that is sort of halfway between medical information and horoscope as to what it all means. You know, what else do they do with that data? You know, how are they marketing it? How are they making money? You know, what does Fitbit do with your data? You know, back to the NSA or other law enforcement or hacker groups. Who else can get at that data and what can they do with it? And these are things that we need to start thinking about, and largely we're not. Google, you know, I think we're going to talk about Google later. You know, what are they doing with our data? You know, this is all sort of in this sea of data we are exuding as we live our life, either walking down the street, going to the bathroom, doing everything in between, and what happens to it.
If I'm reading this Atlantic article correctly, I think it was the conference organizers themselves that came up with this idea, kind of put one over on their attendees as a thought experiment and to make the points that we're discussing here. But as I mentioned,
I think some public venue in the UK that did this, but in aggregate, mm-hmm. that they were able to aggregate data about things like drug use at a rock concert by measuring the outflow, but not individually by person.
Mm-hmm. And did people have to consent to that or no?
I don't think so. I think because it was aggregate, it was believed it was anonymous. And you know, aggregate use probably is anonymous enough. I don't believe there was consent. It's also the UK, which has very different rules than we do.
Right. But I tend to think of the UK and the EU in general as being a bit more privacy sensitive, maybe not in the in terms of surveillance in the UK, certainly. What this made me think of, as I mentioned, is another story we did on the show a while ago about the digital diaper for tracking children's health. And something else that crossed my radar screen, which was helping children get potty trained by plunking an iPad down in front of them. And what this leads me to consider is while, you know, adults may or may not be able to make a rational choice about whether you're going to use a convention center's toilets if there is a notice, and here there was, you know, in this fake scenario, a notice that said something like behavior at these toilets is being recorded for analysis. Access your live data. You could go and watch the data as it was coming in. But for people growing up today who are too young to give legally valid consent, you know, although, as Bruce mentioned, all of us adults are leaving a whole lot of data that could construct a useful profile of us, I think for the children of the world, it's an even bigger equation, and they don't have any say over this. And I wanted to get everyone's take on that. Bruce?
You know, it's sort of interesting to think of the generational differences and what's going to matter and what isn't. There's a lot of notions of privacy that are changing. I mean, some of them are changing because of a generation who is used to being online. Some of it's being changed forcibly by for-profit companies like Facebook, who are changing how people view privacy. I do think that we need to pay attention to how minors and, you know, are going to have to deal with their data as they become older, and whether it's old posts on Zanga or medical information that's flowing into these databases. Now, I don't know how we're going to navigate this. We can't even navigate this for us, let alone for other people. And we're at the point where there's just so much, I think, money and lobbying dollars in collecting and selling our data that we're just not seeing useful reforms. The Do Not Track law is a great example of something that just went badly useless as it went through Congress. And these are deep philosophical issues about, you know, what's going to happen with our stuff, with our data. I hadn't heard of the digital diaper. I mean, you look at it, and it's kind of like the digital thermostat, right? It's a device. It's sitting somewhere in the world, and you can access the data via your phone. And that data is in someone's database. And it's not clear what the rights are, you know, where my rights end and someone else's begin. You know, we have very antiquated laws in the U.S. We are basically, our privacy is based on proximity, that the stuff that's near us, our homes, our cars, our persons, are protected by special laws. Stuff we give to third parties is protected by much less law, the whole third party doctrine. But now we give our most intimate stuff, whether it's information about our child's diapers or our personal email, to a third party. And you know, yet it's our most private stuff.
Well, to that point, in discussing the iDrive, the Mother Jones piece that I put in the rundown, and for those of you listening and watching, if you want to access all of these things that we've looked at to get ready for the show, go to delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/257, and all the links are there. It talked about personal clouds and how it's possible to have all the convenience of cloud storage with greater security than you could get by giving your data to a third party, by doing it yourself. Obviously, that sounds like a better solution than giving the data to a third party. But Bruce, do you think it's just too big a hurdle for most people?
It's certainly not a better solution. I mean, okay, your email is probably more reliably secure on Google's hard drive than on yours. I know my mother, her photos are much safer on Flickr than if she had them herself. The reasons we give our data to third parties are real, and they are compelling. I mean, we're not just goofing off by doing this. We do it for really good reasons. We like the fact that when we lose our computers or phones, we push a button and magically our stuff reappears. There are additional risks, but by and large, I think most of us feel a lot more secure with someone else managing our data, doing the backup, know, making sure that nothing bad happens to it. Because for most people, the biggest security risk is not the NSA or the Chinese government or cyber criminals. It's I lost this stuff. Right? That's our biggest risk. And putting stuff in the cloud protects against that pretty well.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And one I think the legal industry in general needs to get its arms around. Mark, getting back to my point about children and collecting data about them through their parents' consent, but obviously you can't get a three-year-old's consent to that sort of thing. Is this an issue that you think the law is ready and able to cope with?
Not at the moment. You know, it's clearly not something that would be effectively addressed by existing law. I mean, quite frankly, the existing law is COPPA, which has a number of issues and complications, and doesn't even really fit very well, you know, scenarios like the, you know, digital diaper.
No, it just doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, if for no other reason than the entire theory behind COPPA is getting parental consent. And, you know, as you mentioned, you know, the one good thing you can say about a digital diaper is the 3-year old or the 2-year old is not going to buy their own digital diaper. Not yet. So, you know, I think it's going to take some changes in I think it'll take some changes in law. But to be entirely honest with you, I think it's really going to take some changes in culture. I think as a society, we have to make some decisions, which I don't think we've done yet, about what we really consider important and really want to protect and how we want to balance the value of security and protection of our data. Because I agree with Bruce that for most people, the biggest security concern for data is simply losing it. But how do we balance that against the risk of third parties using that data in ways that individuals cannot anticipate? And perhaps the biggest challenge there is the fact that it is so incredibly difficult to anticipate how personal information might be used in the future. You know, even working in this industry, I am frequently surprised by what businesses want to use data for and how they may plan to use it in the future. And I think if you're not a specialist in this field, you would probably be absolutely mystified by the rapid changes in the way that businesses are trying to monetize personal information or, you know, information related to a person. So as not to get too deep into an argument about what constitutes personal information. So I think even before, I suppose the American tradition is that we will try to legislate things before we reach any real cultural conclusions. But I think in order to really resolve these issues, I do think as a society, we need to reach some cultural conclusions about how we value our privacy as opposed to other needs.
Yep. And yeah. I agree, there's nothing worse than an ill-fitting diaper. Kyle, do you have any thoughts before we move on?
Just real fast. So I agree with how the data is used. I'm not sure the data about the diapers could be used in a nefarious way. At least I don't perceive of it like right now. But as far as protecting children and their data, there's tons of movements both on the state and federal level regarding this. And I don't think all teens put everything on Facebook. The intelligence group had a report came out recently that said not, you know, like 20% of them say, no, I don't put a lot of my stuff on Facebook. You have the do not track kids legislation that was introduced last term. You've had, and we may talk about that later. You have California, who's kind of the leader in data privacy or data related legislation, talking about specific laws for minors. And you have COPPA, which has been, you know, renovated several times. So there's attempts here to deal with this. I'm not sure that they're effective. But I do think that the regulatory environment is rich. I just don't know if the FTC is capable of handling it or the state should be doing it.
Yeah, and your point is why I brought this up in the first place. Is like the teenagers I know are not anxious to have a whole lot of information about them out there, and they use Snapchat and other tools like that for that reason.
And so I think the pendulum is starting to swing maybe in the other direction finally.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting collision when perhaps for assisting in parenting or child rearing or keeping track of your child or all the various reasons why it's good for parents to have data about their children will crash head on at some point with a teenager or young adult's desire to be more clandestine. And I'm not sure, you know, what we're going to do with all that and where the law is going to fall out. But we've mentioned Do Not Track a couple of times, and there have been a couple of developments on that that it's worth noting. On the one hand, there's finally some progress on Do Not Track, and at the I always get it confused, WC3, W3C is what it actually is, has finally, finally advanced the TPE, the tracking preference extension specification, to last call status. Now, that's a lot of mumbo jumbo that apparently means that it's getting close to some kind of approval. This came out, well, the article I'm reading about it from the Center for Democracy and Technology was written on April 24th. Hard on the heels of that, on April 30th, Yahoo announced, you know how we were some of the first people to say we were going to do not track? We're not going to do that anymore. So I think if you could read between the lines and see that, you know, the progress that's being made is not fast enough, not effective enough, not enough of an industry standard for someone at least like Yahoo to get behind. Bruce, what do you make of all this?
Well, do not track has always been voluntary. And when you have industries that make their money by tracking you, it's very hard to say to them, you know, don't make your money. So nobody basically pays attention to Do Not Track, you know, and nobody who you care about. If you read their privacy policy, they'll say things like, well, we don't know what Do Not Track means, so we're not going to do anything. Or at best, they track you, but they don't show you targeted ads. So it's instead of Do Not Track, it's track me in secret. You know, for this to change, there has to be laws. And back when the industry thought that only a few percent of people would ever turn that on, they were willing to go with it and it wouldn't bother them. But when it's a third or a quarter, suddenly they're looking at their bottom line and saying, you know, this isn't a law. We're going to ignore it. If you don't like it, too bad. You know, a lot of companies aren't as forthcoming as Yahoo. They just ignore it and don't tell you. But now, no one's going to pay attention to Do Not Track unless they're legally mandated to, because so many people don't want to be tracked, and tracking is the business model of the internet, right? We build systems that surveil people in exchange for services. That's what we do. So Do Not Track is not going to work in that regime. There needs to be some other way for a business to operate than surveillance.
So, Mark, do you think we're close to having the government mandate that some kind of Do Not Track regime be in place?
At this point, I would say no. I think the one notable thing that might come out of the finalization of the TPE, whenever that really is actually finalized, would be that it is supposed to contain a signaling mechanism that would allow, and I'm not sure it would be required, but allow sites to actually respond in an automated fashion to a Do Not Track signal. So, for example, if you come to the website and you indicated that you did not want to be tracked, that when they receive that signal, they would actually send an automated response that would either say, yes, we will not track you, or no, this is not a law, as Bruce pointed out. And we're not going to volunteer to undercut our business model. So we're going to keep tracking, et cetera. And it will be interesting to see whether or not if such a mechanism is implemented in a systematic fashion, whether or not the response rate and I guess a clearer indication that, oh, by the way, no matter how much I've turned on my do not track signal, pretty much every site that I care about is saying, oh, yeah, that was very nice of you, but we're going to continue to track you. Whether that could create the kind of public backlash that may push legislative or regulatory efforts, either from Congress or the FTC. But right now, I think it's still in that realm where both regulators and legislators, they've just finished fighting over this issue. And I think they're going to want to spend some time seeing how Do Not Track plays out in practice, even though so far it's not looking like it's going to be much of a change.
Kyle, you mentioned that last year the Do Not Track Kids Act of 2013 was introduced. That's still pending, right? It's not a law.
Right. No, I don't think it's a law, along with every other Do Not Track attempt that has been done on the federal level. I think the most recent one was actually, and I only remember this name, John Rockefeller. He was the one that introduced the 2013 version of Do Not Track. But this is the very definition of, it's policy oriented, but, do we regulate or do we allow this voluntary laissez-faire kind of self-regulating occur for the tracking? And so it's Do Not Track Kids, Do Not Track Consumers, Consumer Bill of Rights, which has Do Not Track legislation in it. None of these, I think, have made it out of committee ever.
All right. Well, we'll continue to watch that space. And I think you all have made great points that there needs to be a better way of signaling that you or some user on your network does not want to be tracked and then of actually having that wish respected. And we seem to have a divide between those two things at the moment and no solid standard on how to bridge that divide. We're going to have to let Bruce go in a minute here, but Bruce, I thought we'd let you go out by highlighting the interview between John Oliver on his new HBO show and Keith Alexander, the outgoing head of the NSA, which also got written up in the Atlantic as the strangest interview yet with the outgoing head of the NSA. John Oliver, in addition to asking some really weird questions, asked some very hard-hitting ones. There was actually some journalism going on in that interview, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and it's again another, only comedians can do real journalism anymore, and it's we see it again and again. It's so weird and unfortunate. The interview actually is worth watching. Oliver asked some really good questions. I think he gave the best explanation of inadvertent collection I've ever heard, and he did it all in the space of like 4 seconds. Mm-hmm. And Alexander did do a lot of dodging. Unfortunately, Oliver didn't follow up on a lot of things, but you could definitely see Alexander's media training in the way he will acknowledge a question and then shift and answer something else and do that again and again. So it's kind of neat to see that. But yes, I thought these are some of the best questions asked of Alexander that I've ever heard, including being asked in congressional hearings. And unfortunately, also some really bizarre, weird questions. I guess you're going to play some of it, which is good.
Do you think that the NSA is suffering from a perception problem with the American people at the moment, bearing in mind that the answer to that is yes?
Absolutely. The first assumption is that you're collecting on the American people. And therein lies the problem, because the reality is the target is not the American people.
No, the target is not the American people, but it seems that too often you miss the target and you hit the American person standing next to it going, whoa, him.
But you see, we're not just out there gathering U.S. communications, listening to their phone calls, or collecting their emails. But that's the first thing that people jump to.
But you are out there doing that. You're just saying you're not then reading them. You are gathering that data.
No. So in terms of going after U.S. infrastructure or sitting here in the United States, talking to A and B, talking in the United States, we aren't collecting that. We don't collect that. We do collect the metadata, a to, from, number, date, time, group, and duration of a call. That's all that's in there.
But that's not nothing.
No, that's not nothing.
That's significant information. Otherwise, you wouldn't want it. Is this the argument, then, that to get the needle, you need the haystack?
Well, that's part of the argument.
Right, but people's concerns, I think, are that you're not just taking the haystack, you're taking the whole farm.
Right.
And the county and the state, and you've now got some photos of the farmer's wife in the shower as well.
So, NSA is not allowed to go do that on its own. It has oversight. And so what the courts, Congress, and the administration do is say, if you're going to do this, it
there's
has
his
to
media training kicking in right
it
there.
Yeah.
So the question I think the American people really have to ask is, are we doing the right things to protect the nation and our civil liberties and privacy?
So oddly, that's correct. That is what we need to talk about. Right? Yeah. Are we doing the right things? And in a sense, Alexander has a point that he is following what the President Bush and then Obama, what Congress or the courts have told him. He's been very aggressive about increasing that authority. But fundamentally, it is not his job to say, you know, we're not going to do this. It is Congress's job to say, you shouldn't do this, right? Are you doing the right things? And unfortunately, this, you know, back to TSA, as long as we are scared, we're unlikely to say, back off. You know, when we can view what we're doing at airports, what the NSA is doing, with the same horror and amazement as, what do you mean you interned all Japanese during World War II? Or McCarthyism wasn't a joke? You know, we have to actually look back at this time like we look back at those times. Then there'll be reform. But, you know, his point is right there, I think, is a valid one. He's just following orders, and he's doing it aggressively like you'd expect him to do.
Well, of course, we could go on for another hour and have a discussion on the oversight and how we go on addressing the fact that the surveillance in the country might be something that we look back on in several decades with shock and dismay, or are looking at it that way now. But we have so appreciated your being able to spend an hour with us already, Bruce, and we know your time is valuable, and we're going to let you go off and continue writing and analyzing and helping keep us informed about all these issues. So thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything that you want to let people know about coming up with you that they should pay attention to?
Oh, I don't know. I just keep writing and speaking and doing my stuff. So there's nothing important coming in the next soon, but there always is stuff. And I see my blog. You should definitely have me back. This was fun.
Yeah, definitely. We'd love to have you back. Thank you so much for joining us today. And we are going to soldier on. We'll hope to talk to you again soon.
Bye, Bruce.
And this might be a good time for anyone out there who's feeling a little hungry to think about a snack break. And if you're going to think about a snack break, of course, you're going to want to think about naturebox.com. Of course, it's easy to talk about eating right, but when you're starving at 3 p.m. all cranky and lightheaded, that evil vending machine can seem like your only friend. You don't need to give in to it, though. You can keep your eye on looking great and feeling great and head on over to naturebox.com/twit. When you do that, you're going to click on the continue button to choose between three subscription options. Then you can place an order. So what you're going to choose between is either savory or sweet, and spicy is one of the options as well. And I've been sampling these. Our whole family's been sampling them. We can't keep them in the house. They're just too yummy. They go too fast. So you're going to need to, you know, stay on this, make sure you know what snacks you'd like in your monthly box. And then when it comes, I don't know, I just, little word to the wise here, I like to take the good ones and put them away for a little while until I'm good and hungry. So I know that they're going to be there in the pantry and maybe a little too high for my 10-year-old to have gone in and snagged before I could get to them. You can select your dietary needs. They have a vegan option, soy-free, gluten-conscious, lactose-free, nut-free, and non-GMO. You can also do the taste, as I mentioned, savory, sweet, or spicy. They send great tasting snacks right to your door with free shipping anywhere in the U.S. There are healthy and satisfying snacks like barbecue kettle kernels, French toast granola. I haven't tried that one yet. That sounds amazing. And over 100 more, all with zero trans fat, zero high fructose corn syrup, and nothing artificial. It's the snack happy gift that keeps on giving. You can order NatureBox for a 3, 6, or 12-month subscription. Order it for yourself, order it for a family member, order it for a friend who you know needs to be paying attention to healthy snacks. Swimsuit weather is almost here. Time to snack smarter. Forget the vending machine and get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like honey mesquite almonds. So remember, to get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. Stay full, stay strong. Go to naturebox.com/twit. And we thank NatureBox for their support of This Week in Law. All right, guys. Let's see. We were talking about John Oliver. I don't know if I got everyone else's take yet. Let's start with you, Mark. Was this an eye-opener for you? I know that just from the fact, you know, the little bit that we watched there, John Oliver was not letting him get off the hook by giving platitudes as answers.
I suppose it was maybe not eye-opening, but it was interesting in that initially I was surprised that General Alexander agreed to do John Oliver's show.
Nothing surprises me after the president of the United States sat between two ferns. All bets are off at that point.
That is true. That is true. Well, not to slander General Alexander, but he's never struck me as being as good an improver as the president. It felt a little bit like a trap to me. Now, not that there's any mystery to what John Oliver was going to do, and you know that's why I watch a show. But you know, I think it was, you know, I guess I have to agree in large part with Bruce in that eventually General Alexander did get to, you know, what I think is the key point, which is he is generally following his mission. And while I know the jury is still out on the legality of a lot of the things the NSA was doing, my interpretation is that quite a bit of it probably was legal, and that, you know, it's maybe more important for us as a society to start thinking about, you know, do we want to be empowering intelligence agencies to be this aggressive or have the capability to be that aggressive in surveilling American civilians. Because I think to a certain degree, we have in fact given the NSA that power, and that may have been a mistake. One that we should probably try to step back from.
Do you think that we will have to congressionally step back from it? Or do you think that any of these cases that are pending challenging the laws that make this kind of surveillance legal on constitutional grounds, do you think that they have a chance?
I think they have some chance. You know, there are obviously questions of first impression in almost every case. So it's a little difficult to predict how things will play out. And ultimately, I think these are issues that are going to have to be decided by the Supreme Court. And, you know, some of the justices are already – they're not signaling how they're going to vote. But I do think they're starting to signal their sympathies in that, you know, I think Justice Scalia would very much like to never hear any of these cases. And, you know, not that he will be a rubber stamp to the government, but I think he's already expressing some great concern that he doesn't feel that it's the court's role to get into these issues. So my instinct is that a legislative solution is probably the best approach or the best course for reining in this kind of authority, because I think it's going to be very hard for the courts to really rein all of the surveillance program in. I think, you know, I think there will, if it's left to the courts, there will always be a little bit of wiggle room for agencies like the NSA to test the boundaries. And I think, unfortunately, the political reality is that the NSA, I think most of the motivations for the NSA will always be to push the boundaries, because no one's ever going to give anyone at the NSA a medal for protecting the liberties of Americans, but they will be held accountable for any terrorist attack. So there's very little incentive for the NSA to be activist in protecting civil liberties and privacy.
Yes, that's an excellent point. Yeah. Kyle, any thoughts on this before we move on?
Yeah, just that the NSA was doing illegal stuff. It was. So there was a decision by the head of the FISA court, the court that hears all these things, and the judge basically said that they were misbehaving or misrepresenting the information. And additionally, mm-hmm. in the John Oliver interview, there was a number of NSA employees that were using the powers that they had abusively to look up girlfriends, tax records, you know, ex-husbands, ex-wives. So there is illegal activity going on. I would be surprised, however, if the legislature undid the FISA court structure, because that seems to be the go-to for the government when they're saying, no, no, there is absolutely oversight. It's in the form of a courtroom ruling. However, that 2011 ruling said, well, you know, you failed in this regard. So what liability does that open up for these other cases that have been referred to the Department of Justice regarding the abuses of the NSA privileges? That's an open question, by the way.
Yeah. And I think it's going to remain one. We'll have to stay tuned on that. Let's do one more story in sort of this privacy and maybe moving on to the legislation and regulation and policy arena. We're sort of going there organically anyway. And Mark, since you're our expert in that area, is there something in particular that's still in the rundown that we haven't gotten to that you really, really wanted to discuss today?
Actually, I think we hit the most interesting topics, or the most notable topics, so far. So unless there was, something in particular that you or Kyle, wanted to discuss, I am happy to move on to other topics.
Well, I guess, want to touch on warrants just for a moment. So why don't we, then that is okay. One of our, policy, topics. So why don't we go there next? We had a couple of cases argued in the Supreme Court, no decisions yet, but argument was this week on warrantless cell phone searches. And I wondered if you had any takeaways for us on those cases, Mark.
I guess I would say that I didn't notice anything that I would necessarily consider a surprise. And I think that, you know, the courts are still struggling with the idea of how to handle, that's the best way to put this politely. How to handle technology that the law had not really anticipated, and so I still think that at core, the cases tend to boil down to trying to find their way through those types of issues, but I'm hard pressed to find a real meaningful pattern out of the law so far. So I think that's, and I don't necessarily think that's changed recently. And so I suppose that has been a bit of a frustration on my part, because I would love to be able to find a pattern that would make advising clients a lot easier.
Right.
But but right now, I suppose that tends to be my initial reaction every time some of these cases come out. It's just like, oh,
yeah,
wonderful. Another but to tell my client. But if you do this, and then if you do that, then this.
Right. So the two cases, for people who haven't been following them, one is called Riley versus California, and involved a guy who was stopped for having expired license plates. Then there were guns in the car, and they searched his phone and found photos and videos that seemed to connect him with gang activity. So the question is, could they do that without a warrant? And then in U.S. versus Worry, a man was arrested for dealing drugs, and then his phone kept ringing with a call from, quote unquote, my house. Then the police went on to the alleged dealer's phone to get the number that was calling him, tracked that to a house that seemed to belong to him. And then after getting a warrant, went in and found drugs, cash, and a gun. So they searched his phone in order to find his house. And the good news is, it seems like the justices, in hearing these cases, are at least getting the distinction that a phone seems to have, or perhaps intuitively should seem to have, more privacy value than something like your Twitter feed or what you're putting on Facebook. The reason, the expectations of privacy in those kinds of situations are different. Kyle, anything on this before we move into more copyright related issues?
Sure. We covered this in my cyber law class pretty closely because we knew the cases were coming up this year. Additionally, mm-hmm. one of them happened here in South Boston. So it was even mm-hmm. more regional interest there. And I'd just like to point out that there are people in the world that carry two things. This is my Samsung Galaxy. This is my old-fashioned phone, which is untraceable. There was some discussion in the court that if you have two cell phones, it means it must be drug activity. And some people were very curious by that. But the idea is that these cases may expand an important exception to this, which is the scope of searches incident to arrest. And that's really important. And I think the difference between my two phones will be the difference in these cases, perhaps, because the smartphone that I have does have what some of the justices says, my entire life. Whereas in the U.S. First Circuit case, the one that happened here in South Boston, it was an old-fashioned phone that was actively receiving calls at the time period that was incidental to the arrest. And I think the justices they have to find a middle ground that doesn't make it a narrow exception for the police to determine at this time, what level of technology is this? What app is this? There was a lot of discussion of making an exception for particular apps that share certain amounts of technology, but that's not going to work in an environment where you have these searches incident to an arrest. So I'm hoping that what I heard when I listened to the arguments is that both ends of the court will come to some middle ground, but it will be difficult.
Well, warrantless search and... Go ahead, Mark.
Oh, no, I was just going to tell you, Kyle, if it makes you feel any better, I also have an old dumb phone and a smartphone. So
it does make you feel better.
Wow. Why? I mean, is it for security and privacy purposes, or is it inertia?
This phone is old. It's got all my contacts on it, and mm-hmm. I know I don't have to worry about downloading an app that accidentally shares all my information with anyone. This is a privacy phone. The tab I use more for work, accessing email and stuff like that. But I know that anything I share on there with any third party apps is not mine. I don't assume any privacy with that Galaxy.
Isn't that fascinating?
I'm strange.
Look, Mark's in the same boat. Is it for the same reason, Mark?
Pretty similar reasons. I do like the dumbness of my dumb phone, although it is traceable on some levels, but not nearly as much as my smartphone. And to be entirely honest with you, I still actually just prefer talking on traditional clamshell phones. The smartphones to me are still in that fuzzy middle ground between a real tablet with real screen real estate and a phone that's easy to put anywhere. And So I find them more useful for things like email and not necessarily for talking. So.
Yeah. No, Harvard law professor and an InfoSec lawyer are both using clamshell phones for privacy reasons, at least in part. That says something.
We're all probably thinks I'm crazy right now.
I don't think so.
It may be a Harvard connection there. I went to the law school, so
there we go.
It's a Cambridge connection.
That's right.
Cambridge and clamshells, potential show title. Yeah. All right. I was going to just highlight the fact, again, over at the Center for Democracy and Technology, they are monitoring the fact that there is a White House petition that's pending and has gotten over 100,000 signatures about warrantless surveillance as opposed to warrantless search. And it still hasn't gotten the White House response yet. So, you know, they actually have a clock running days. The White House has remained silent on warrantless seizures. So, and there's a site, notwithoutawarrant.com. So if these are issues that are near and dear to your heart, that might be something to go check out. But in the meantime, let's move on to some copyright issues. Let's talk about ebooks, Kyle, and the fact that Boo Radley is now digital. To Kill a Mockingbird is finally an ebook, but there are lots of books that aren't. So can you kind of give us the lay of the land there?
Sure. I believe it or not, I'm kind of against the current ebook model, speaking on my library side. Mm-hmm. So traditionally, libraries buy books, put them on the shelves, make them available to the public. Very important in communities where they can't afford, you know, electronic internet access or books. This is the place they go for information. The ebook world has developed a model that they learned from the software industry in the 80s and 90s, which is don't sell your product so that it is subject to an actual sale. Because if it's subject to an actual sale, the first sale doctrine, which we saw litigated in Kurtzang last year in the Supreme Court, says that once I buy a book, I can sell it to somebody else. I can give it away. I can loan it. This is how libraries exist. But what they're doing with ebooks now is that they are licensing or leasing it to us. So you and I buy an Amazon book. We store it on our tab. We don't actually own that book. In fact, the license says they can come in and take it away from us anytime they want, virtually. It's much like that I don't own a copy of Microsoft Word on my laptop. It is licensed to me. This impacts libraries greatly because we want to be able to provide the users with the books and we want to enter into the digital arena, but we are subject to these licenses, which basically takes away our ability to develop collections because we have to pay onerous prices for access to these ebooks. So these ebook contracts, and including the one for To Kill a Mockingbird, which Harper Lee actually gave over to, the intent here, she said, I'm still old fashioned. I love dusty old books and libraries. Her actually signing this over into an ebook actually hurts the very libraries she tends to protect or love. And this is all part of something called the secondary market. eBay, used bookstores, used record stores, et cetera, exist because of this first sale doctrine, which is very much tied to traditional kind of print media oriented world. What I'd like to see is ebook sales that are not licensed, but are actually sold. That way libraries continue upon their mission of providing information and access to literature, to fiction, to nonfiction, to their communities. That was a lot.
But no, it's a lot, and it's a really good point. And I'm going to refrain from making any comments about clamshell phones in connection with this. But no, I think it's an excellent point, and that you end on the point that perhaps we need to rethink the way that ebooks are sold and actually enable actual sales of ebooks. But from my standpoint, it doesn't seem like that's something we can really look forward to in the future. I don't see a trend in that direction. Do you?
Well, there's attempts going on right now. And I know Digital Public Library of America and other large consortial groups that are library oriented are thinking of, should we have a national ebook library platform where, mm-hmm, there is ownership of these works and we can collect and maintain you know, digital preservation is as important as print preservation, and that we maintain this cultural institution, which libraries are in many ways. We're preserving the culture that exists at a time period, and you know, the idea of libraries as the holders of forever. So the intent here is to maybe do this. Some places are doing it by specifically developing their own ebook content, their own ebook platform, and not signing away the rights to a large conglomerate Amazon-like ebook company. Why not write the publishers, write the authors, and get permission yourself and be able to loan ebooks, be able to collect ebooks? And if, you know, if 100 years from now somebody wants to see an edition that was only available in ebook, the library will be able to have kept it because they have bought it. So there is a mission. Now, the publishers don't want this. In fact, they price ebooks, you know, 10 to 20 to 300% higher than what an average consumer will pay. A book that costs you and I $9.99 to download off of Amazon will cost a library upwards of $180 or $250.
Wow.
Because they're afraid of, and they're afraid of something that's not happening in libraries, piracy. It's libraries, you know, we're information professionals. We follow the law. We're collecting, we're making collections available to our communities. We're not contributing to the piracy problem, but yet we're lumped in there a lot.
Is part of the rationale just that the one copy at a library will be read by so many more people, even if it's not pirated?
Absolutely. There is that element to it. So there was a HarperCollins famously introduced into their ebook policy that you had to repay for the book, the ebook, every 26 times, meaning it was mimicking the life cycle of a book. So 26 checkouts and you have to pay for the whole book again. Now, that was, the library community was up in arms about this because we have books here in our library that have been lent hundreds of thousands of times and are still in perfect shape. So the idea that it's 26 times and you have to pay again is mimicking the life cycle of book is insane. It's just, it's a kind of a methodology, a business practice to drive out the middleman who they perceive of as us libraries.
It sounds to me like this is something authors should be paying attention to. And if it's important to you as an author to make sure that libraries are able to have a digital collection of your works, that this is something you're going to want to negotiate with your publisher.
Absolutely. But as we may know, publisher contracts are not really the most flexible forms of contracts. So, you know, what it has to happen is that the more popular authors, the breadwinners, have to consider this when they're looking at these publishing contracts, which, again, these contracts are as old as the library systems themselves. So when Harper Lee agreed to this, I was thinking, oh, my goodness, wouldn't it be great if she said, no, they're going to actually buy the book and own it on their Kindle. That would be an incredible kind of move. And as this article points out, there's a number of other great books out there that are not available right now on ebooks, but will be available in your local library. So let's try and build the collection of these. I don't know if they go over the top 10. There it is. You know, these are important books in our society. So it's the idea that maybe we could allow libraries to own these and preserve them for the future in that digital content capacity.
Well, somewhat along these lines, equally important to our society and culture is to have not just a print, but a digital record of the political thought and philosophy that has given rise to our current political climate. Tell us how someone could possibly claim a copyright on the writings of Karl Marx at this point.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So this is copyright law is such a headache sometimes. So in this case, as they know, the Karl Marx, the Marxist Internet Archive, which had hosted free versions of the writings. The problem was that they are under copyright because they are translated works. So translation triggers a new, in some legal regimes, a new copyright. And so the irony in all this is that I you know, and I'm not a studied Marxist, but I have a feeling that he would reject this assertion over his works not being free to the world. So this
one would think,
yeah, I mean, it's and that it happened on May Day, I think, was double down for the folks that are the Marxists in this world. And the idea that this is being done for the exact reason, kind of the Harper Lee argument I had, that they want to take it offline so they can digitize it and then sell it to libraries. And they would be unable to sell it to libraries digitally if there was a free version already online.
Yes, that is a tragedy. So this is there a solution to this? This is just going to happen. The free versions are down now, and maybe there will be a pay version available at some point in the future.
Yeah, the from what I've read, and I've looked at a couple blogs about this because it was a shocker, is that it's down for now. That there is a petition being formed to try and reverse this, or at least maybe offer some version of it, maybe that doesn't have as many scholarly notes, or that is somehow, you know, because every time this gets translated or people add third-party content to it, there's a potential for it to be recopyrighted. This is what they do with Shakespeare in England. You know, I retranslated the original into my new version of this play, so I'm going to claim copyright over it yet again. And this happens internationally more than it does domestically here in the United States, but it's because there's more translations in Europe where there are more countries speaking different languages that are on top of each other. But I don't see this coming back online unless the goodwill of the petitioners and other people point out to this publisher the massive irony in taking down these works.
Yeah, one would hope that's not lost on them. Let's move on to a final story today, and it moves us into the world of entertainment. All right, so we've kind of come full circle back to privacy considerations here. Hulu has been under fire for some time about the information that it was sharing about subscribers with Facebook. Kyle, can you bring us up to speed on the latest there?
Sure. So there's a law called the Video Privacy Protection Act, which basically says you're not allowed to tell people what videos individuals are renting. Now, and we'll talk about how that act origins came about maybe in just a moment, but the idea is that Hulu is doing that in a particular way that this California federal judge did not like. Now, Hulu does privatize the data somehow, but the unique identifiers that they share with Facebook, so it says, hey, I'm watching this movie, hey, I'm watching this movie, the idea that even those unique identifiers may trigger enough for someone to reverse engineer in a way the name of the individual, or they'd be sharing this information without permission. The judge found that it was at least a good enough claim to go forward. It doesn't mean they're necessarily guilty, but it's that these identifiers are not, I guess, secret enough. I've had trouble understanding the decision. But there's disclosure enough to the effect that it may violate the VPPA.
Right. And tell us a bit about that law. And again, this is a law that was enacted some time ago, and it's sort of not a perfect fit, much like an ill-fitting diaper, to put yes. something like Hulu into it.
Sure.
So can you give us some context there?
Sure, absolutely. So for those that are watching, there used to be something called video stores. And these were places you went into, and you could, if you remember far back as I do, one side was VHS, the other side was Betamax, and you could rent movies there. When I explained this to my students, who have no idea what Blockbuster is anymore or what a video store is, I like to say, one time Netflix had a store. So what happened was, is there was a video shop called Potomac Video that was in Washington, D.C. And this was during the 1987 Robert Bork nomination, which was had a whole bunch. Oh, there it is. Had a whole bunch of political components to it. There was a reporter that went into the video shop where he knew Bork took out videos and said, hey, could I look at his video rental records just for curiosity's sake? And the person that was there said, well, absolutely, because there was no law at the time preventing you from sharing that type of information. Now, there wasn't anything too nefarious in there, but you can imagine that the people in D.C. that were renting from various video stores in that area that were tied to government somehow might have freaked out about that. because also, for those of you that don't remember video stores, there was also a back room in these video stores that you had to be 18 or up to go in and see these videos. Those would also be recorded in the video log. So I think a lot of people were afraid that peeking at these records would violate some sort of privacy you have about your movie watching and your viewing habits. And so they passed the VPPA in 1988, which, by the way, very quick for Congress. This is the 80s when things got done quickly, especially if it was going to impact a potential nominee by the President of the United States. And so move that VHS up into the modern era. We have Netflix, we have Hulu, we have all this I'm sharing what I'm watching online, and it actually forced in 2009 or 2008 for the law to be amended to include these social networking sites that were sharing information about what their users were watching. Now, it wasn't VHS videos, it was streaming movies, but it had the same effect. So the irony in all this is that this store, and I can't believe it was still open, just closed this week. After 33 years, there was still a video store in D.C. Amazing.
That is stunning. But then you guys are using clamshell phones, so I'm just gonna be stunned by anything.
I didn't go. I haven't rented a video for Blockbuster in almost 3 years.
Yes. Well, it just, you know, as someone who's forked over back in the day, so many late fees to that particular entity, it just warms my heart in a very Schadenfreudian way that your students have just never even heard of Blockbuster. Mark, any thoughts on Hulu and other online video providers and their sharing of data with Google, Facebook, others who are trying to create the most complete data profile of you possible?
Well, a couple of points. One, I actually went to the going out of business sale at Potomac Video about
great.
A week and a half ago, and actually pretty much for nostalgia purposes, it was just awesome to walk into a video store again, just to sort of see the concept again. And I think, you know, on a more substantive point for this case, I've actually done a fair amount of work on the VPPA over the last couple of years. I think it was sort of this stealth privacy law that caught a couple of internet companies completely by surprise. And, you know, related to the issue or to sort of the question and issue in the Hulu case, I think a good precedent to note is that a few years ago, Netflix, as an experiment, released a set of records of their customer records, which they had anonymized, or they believed they had anonymized, to researchers, for the purposes of doing social science research, et cetera. And it was very quickly discovered that despite Netflix attempts to anonymize that data, that researchers could re-identify the vast majority. I don't think it was 100%, but it was the vast majority of the users and their video selections. And so, you know, that was actually the event that or one of the events that brought the VPPA back to life, so to speak, with regard to the internet, and is largely at the core of the decision here with Hulu, which is that basically what the court concluded was that Anonymization is more a matter of context than an absolute. You know, if you, particularly if you're retaining any ability to keep a record or maintain a record that is unique to an individual, it becomes mathematically very difficult to make it hard to re-identify that individual. So having a unique ID for an individual account, so an individual Hulu account that may match a individual Facebook account, makes it incredibly difficult, statistically speaking, to really make information anonymous. And so basically the court concluded that we can't simply say, because we removed the name, the phone number, the address, the traditional identifiers, that one can assume that that information is now anonymous, because it's become actually quite easy. Well, I don't want to say easy, but it's quite possible for a qualified statistician to re-identify a great deal of information that may have been, in a layman's sense, rendered anonymous. So I think it's an important precedent, really, for privacy law in general, because there isn't a lot of guidance on what constitutes anonymization in privacy law outside of the HIPAA context, which covers health information. There's a very specific set of rules for health information, but for just traditional internet clickstream information, or I guess records of your video watching habits, there's very little guidance out there as to what constitutes meaningful anonymization. And I think it's going to be important to watch how this case progresses, you know, once they actually get into fact finding,
to really see
how much they can, you know, can the plaintiffs actually prove that it would have been relatively easy to re-identify that information? And if so, I think that could set a really important precedent, for a number of industries, not just those in sort of the streaming video business.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. I don't know if you guys caught it during our quantified toilet discussion, but Bruce seemed to be expressing the opinion there that, you know, at least for sort of good enough purposes, it might be possible to anonymize data. And I certainly have heard a lot of skepticism on that front. So we'll have to see what the court here makes of all of the conflicting views around that. What were you going to say, Kyle?
I think it's also a subject of the area that this is from. So this is a California federal district mm-hmm. court. And California, as I said, is keenly aware of kind of, data protections. They've been ahead in this area with notice of data breach laws. They have very specific definitions of what is personally identifiable information, or PII. And so I think, even though I think she gave too much weight to this, you know, you'd have to get a statistician to get in there and this and that, I think it's a subject of the area of the country that this is coming from. The judges there are very aware of how you can reconstruct things into PII based on the statutes that they have at both the state and the federal level. So that may be a little bit of it.
Yep. I live in California, and I can tell you people, you know, just anecdotally, people do discuss and are concerned with the issue. And so I'm not surprised that lawmakers and judges here are. Let's move on to our tip and resources of the week. Our tip of the week is a funny one. I forget exactly who it was that tweeted this my way. It has to do with witness preparation and how much might be too much. And I guess this has been around for a while, but an article just came out in the New York Times. And it's an excerpt from a deposition transcript. It was a deposition in Ohio that involved the definition of a photocopier. And I'm not sure why having someone admit there was a photocopy machine in their office was clearly of critical importance to this case, but the witness had been very, very well coached on this issue, perhaps to an extreme. So the tip, I guess, that I'm trying to glean from this is, you know, coach your witnesses well, but don't make them look ridiculous. So let's play something. What they did here is there was no actual video from the depot, so these are actors.
Do you have photocopying machines at the recorder's office? If you don't know what that means in an office setting, please tell the court you don't know what that means in an office setting to have a photocopying machine.
I would like to answer your question to the best of my ability.
I'm asking you to answer that.
So if you could explain to me what you mean by...
I'm not going to do that, because I want to establish on the record that you really don't know what it is. I want to establish that. Now, do you know what it is or do you not know what it is? Do you understand what that term means in common parlance or not?
Common parlance?
Common language.
I'm sorry. I didn't know what that meant. I understand that there are photocopying machines and there are different types of them, just like there
are
different
cars. Are there any in the recorder's
office? Some of them run under gas power, some of them under electric power, and I'm asking if you could help me out by explaining what you mean by photocopying
machine. That's a great point.
Instead of trying to make me feel stupid.
If you feel stupid, it's not because I'm making you feel that way.
Objection. I have self-confidence, and I have no problem.
I don't think you're stupid.
I think I don't have any problem answering the question.
I think you're playing games with me.
Dave, the word photocopying is at issue in this case, and you're asking him whether something is or isn't a photocopy machine, which is a legal conclusion.
This isn't a patent case. There's no statute that defines where I'm asking him to define technology for me. I'm asking, I want to find out from a layperson's perspective, not from an engineer's perspective, not from a technician's perspective, but from... I have an idea. How about this? Have you ever heard the term photocopier or photocopy used in the recorder's office by anybody?
Photocopy? I'm sure in the time I've been there, someone has used the term.
And have you ever heard them use it in referencing a particular device or machine within the recorder's office? By way of example, can you photocopy that for me? That's an example of office parlance.
That particular terminology I've not witnessed.
You should so watch good. The whole thing. It's hysterical. But the guy is just so well coached. He is answering each question very, very literally. But I don't know. We've got two very smart lawyers on here with me. Do you think that the poor guy is too well coached here and that when you're this literal in your answers, you're just making yourself look like a putz? What do you think, Kyle?
I think they have a great thing where he keeps looking over at the lawyer, you know, and I've seen that in depositions where he's like, okay, say you don't know or you don't recall or that please help me define this. Yes, he's clearly overcoached, but there's actually the last 2 seconds of that is the surprise at the end of the actual use of the word, which is the best. He was really making him literally. And imagine this case, which I think settled and did not go to trial. Imagine if they were going to go head to head on just that definition of that word, how bad this case was going to be afterwards. That's what I was thinking.
Yes. Any thoughts, Mark?
I have to say that as overcoached as that witness was, I have had occasions in my career where I think that would have been preferable.
See, I think you're right. It's a toughie.
It's a very tight line, but it's not. And I don't know if you've ever seen the video it's very old. They used to show the CEO that would barge into deposition prep and, you know, basically say, "Oh, I know how to talk to anybody," and, you know, just totally ignore all of their attorney's advice about deposition prep. And so it's so hard to find the middle ground between those two types of deposition witnesses.
Yeah.
Yes, you do want to try and strike that middle ground. And I guess that would be our tip of the week for anyone who might find themselves in the position of having to be a witness, and any lawyer who is trying to coach a credible witness. We have a couple of resources for you. The first one is a cool newsletter that folks who tune in regularly to this show will enjoy. It's by EFF's Parker Higgins, who's been on with us before, hopefully will be again, and Sarah Jung, who I think is a Harvard law student. Do you know Sarah?
I do know Sarah. In fact, Sarah has written for our Fair Use blog, and Sarah is a graduating 3L.
Excellent. So they are writing this awesome little newsletter called Five Useful Articles, 5UA for short, that comes nicely to your email inbox. And they have all kinds of good inside baseball about the kinds of things we've been talking about today. I think both of them, it sounds like, attended the Aereo article or argument and were giving their thoughts and impressions of that. I think I found this in your Twitter stream, Kyle. And do you have any other thoughts to add?
Sarah and Parker are two of the best writers about breaking stuff down, both in a humorous and serious manner in this thing. And it comes to your inbox weekly. It is insightful. Some of the best description, because they were at the Aereo arguments and they typed it as Aereo Thereo, because they were there.
That was their hashtag.
Absolutely. It was brilliant. And actually, Sarah's analysis of the levels of technology of each justice is profoundly brilliant. So I would check that out. Subscribe to that newsletter. It's fantastic.
Good, good. And then Mark over at the infolawgroup.com site has some great advice. If you are a company who would like to avoid having a debacle occur like the Target data breach, the takeaway I got from your article there, Mark, is to have a completely walled off subnetwork where you're going to keep sensitive data. And you even suggest that the sysadmins have completely separate access, you know, to that subnetwork than they would to any other part of the network. You want to expand on that for us?
Sure. So the basic idea is that in my experience, I've worked with a lot of companies where segmenting their networks has been a bit of a lifesaver for security purposes, because like a lot of companies struggle with security because they approach it as something they have to do for their entire network in order to protect certain particularly sensitive types of data. And, you know, they can make their lives tremendously easier by simply identifying, you know, where is the important information and where does it actually need to go, and keep it in those places, keep it in those areas, and segment your network accordingly. Because, you know, quite often what you'll find is that most of the people in your company simply do not need access to all the payment card information. Even when you're a retailer, there are very few people in your company who really actually need to have access to the systems that handle payment cards. And if you can successfully segment your network, you not only make it a lot harder for people to break in because they have to, you know, you've added another layer of defense to protect yourself, but you can also, you know, moderate your regulatory requirements by making sure that all of your PCI, which is the payment card industry data security standard, requirements only really have to be met by the segment of your network that handles and accesses payment card data. And you don't have to worry about making, you know, the systems used by your salespeople PCI compliant, because frankly, they should never see payment card information in the first place.
Yeah. And I think it's a really great, you talk about having an information security strategy, and I think it's a great way to think about things for businesses that, you know, of course you want your entire network to be secure, but there is some information that it's far worse if it gets out than, you know, yes, you're going to have some upset employees if their emails get read, but you're going to have far more problems if your entire PCI database, as you mentioned, is out there in the wild. So having different layers of having sort of, you know, strong security in one place and super strong, you know, as you talk about DMZs, demilitarized zones, and MZs, militarized zones, making sure that the really important stuff is really, really tightly locked down, I think is great advice for any company, a great way to look at it. So you can check out more about this at the Information Law Group site. Guys, I have had so much fun on this show today. I really can't thank you enough for joining me. I've really learned a lot. I hope people who have been listening have. And it's been an interesting and engaging discussion. Before I go to you guys to say goodbye, I'm remembering, without even Sue the writer in chat reminding me to do it, that we need a second MCLE passphrase for the show in order to help out those people who are showing their oversight folks that they did, in fact, watch or listen. And that second phrase is going to be the back room. So now we've got our phrases in. I can thank once again Mark Paulding from the Info Law Group for joining us today. Mark, so great of you to come in. We miss Evan, of course, but it's been wonderful getting to know you.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Tell us if there's anything coming up, anything you want to plug that people should be aware of.
Nothing immediate. There may be some blogging in my near future, but that's going to require me to fit that into my schedule. But you'll probably see some more blogging activity from me next week. Fun security stuff for those who find security fun.
Yes, I am all for intermittent blogging when there's great substance to it. So keep plugging away at it, and we'll keep looking at your blog on the Information Law Group site and keep up with what you're keeping up with there. And Kyle Courtney from Harvard, what a pleasure your students must have in your classes. You're so engaging and eloquent and understand these issues so well. Of course, it is Harvard University, so one would expect little else. But we're so glad that you could join us today.
Happy to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. It was a lot of fun.
Aside from paying attention to making sure that digital works have adequate representation and availability in libraries, what else should people be paying attention to? And is there anything either in the library system at Harvard or elsewhere there that you think that people need to know about?
Sure. So I always kind of make a plug for something called Digital Public Library of America, DPLA, which is making an attempt to combine all the libraries, archives, special collections around the United States to create a cultural archive of our works, our history, our photos, our books. So I would say check that out. It's very interesting. And a lot of the leadership in that feel the same way I do about libraries and preserving our heritage here. And doing it in a consumer-friendly and citizen-accessible way. Thank you.
Very good.
Oh, there it is. Oh, very nice.
Yes. So we will definitely check that out, and I will put it in our discussion points for this episode of the show, so it's there with everything else we talked about today. Thanks, again to Bruce Schneier for taking time out of his day to join us and help us better understand all the privacy and information security issues that we discussed with him. We do the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC on the Twit Network. That's when we record live, and you can join us live, which is always fun. But you can always join us on your own time, too. If that time slot doesn't work for you, head on over to twit.tv/twill. Our archive is there. If YouTube works out better for you, go to youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. If you use a Roku box, we've got our very own channel there. That makes it very convenient. And we've got some other places that, aside from just watching the show, you can reach out and communicate with us. Evan Brown is usually here, and you can email him at evan@twit.tv. I'm denise@twit.tv. He's Internet Cases on Twitter. I'm D Howell over there. We also have Facebook and Google Plus pages for the show where you can get in touch with us. Let us know what you thought, any questions or anecdotes that came to mind after you listened to the great people that we have on the show explaining and giving their insights about these difficult and interesting issues. We love to hear suggestions from you about what we should discuss, suggestions about guests, suggestions about anything at all. So get in touch with us. We love to hear from you. Actually, we could not do this show without the great participation we get from our audience. And so thank you so much for that. Thanks again to our wonderful guests. Thanks so much to our wonderful Victor on the board in the studio. And we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.